Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show. I'm Josh Fennett.
And I'm Henry Rees-Sheridan. On today's show, we hone in on one of the toughest subjects in architecture, the changing use and role of concrete.
For a long time, people have decried these buildings as ugly. And I think when people say ugly, what they mean is difficult. You know, in the way that art can be difficult, or a novel can be difficult, or a film can be difficult. You need time to understand.
Renowned for its cheapness and durability, concrete has become one of the most simultaneously decried and admired materials in the 20th century architecture.
Today we ask about its future, tell a few forgotten stories about its brutalist past, and mull over the unlikely revival of this most polarizing of products.
All that to come right here on Section D on Monocle 24. And Henry, what an exciting show we've got ahead of us. I notice in the pantheon of great places journalists are able to send themselves, when we were mulling over the idea of doing a show on concrete, you set the sights relatively low, I would argue, to Sheffield.
I'm quick to jump to Sheffield at any given opportunity, as you know, Josh. I visited it last year, I think it was in June or July for Sheffield Design Week, and had such a good time and learned so much about the design history of the city. I was very keen to go back. I really do love it, actually, I have to say.
And we've got a little documentary done by you, which is coming up a little bit later on in the show. But I think it's important to talk about this as a concept and why we think it's so interesting. Concrete, you know, it's a term in the English language for permanence, isn't it? It actually idiomatically means something that lasts a long time. But I think it's an interesting material to hone in on, and I'm sure you agree, because of the way it's changed in over the 20th century particularly.
I think in particular the different associations have come to be attached to it. I mean, it was, you know, as we're going to discuss over the course of the programme, very much linked to optimism, hope, post-war consensus and social cohesion in the 50s and 60s, and it came to represent, many would say, the very opposite to that, as many of the projects, particularly the public projects that it was that was used for, didn't function as well as was originally intended.
And I think at the time there was a lot of letter writing to newspapers in the UK here about these so-called ugly buildings, you know, springing up in places like Hampstead, and people were very, very worried about what this was going to do to architecture. But there's been a sort of welcome revival. People like the light, the look of things. The Barbican Centre right here in London is a great example of a building that was decried for a long time and has become a kind of part of people's kind of passion for architecture. So let's not dilly-dally any longer than we need to. You spoke to Christopher Beanland, journalist for The Independent and design writer.
I did, yeah. He really likes concrete. He likes it so much. He's written a whole book about it. It's called Concrete Concept, and he joined me in the studio to talk about it and concrete.
You can have concrete buildings that aren't brutalist, and you can have brutalist buildings that aren't concrete, but when the two of those things go together, for me, I think that's the sort of perfect marriage. I think the best brutalist buildings are the ones that are the kind of abstracted, raw concrete ones that look very elemental and very powerful.
Why did brutalist architects turn to concrete to express what they were trying to express through their buildings?
There's obviously a lot of reasons, kind of, you know, social and historical reasons why concrete became the material that was used at that time. One of the main reasons is that it gave the opportunity to be very creative. So you could have these very interesting shapes, very large buildings, all kinds of cantilevers. So there was a great freedom for expression. Also, I think because it was a sort of time when, as Barnabas Calder in his new book, Raw Concrete, which is really good, he points out that energy was very cheap in that sort of post-war period. So concrete was sort of a natural choice because you could just make lots of it. And it was sort of not exactly cheap to use. It could be cheap to make, though the design and the craftsmanship that went into it could be quite expensive as well. So, yeah, I think it's kind of the marriage of all those things.
There was a lot of social thought and philosophy that got tangled up with the brutalist movement. That was an ungenerous way of putting it, but, you know, that was kind of synonymous with it. Do you think concrete as a material is itself political?
You can always attach different meanings to buildings. And the kind of cliche almost that sort of sprung from the era is that brutalism is a kind of left-wing style of building. And we kind of associate it with communist countries and also with the welfare state. And it certainly was a big part of that. Interestingly, it can come from the sort of other side as well. So you have a lot of churches in Germany, which for my nonfiction book I've explored, and they're incredible spaces. A lot of them are very undiscovered, and you can have things like prisons and corporate headquarters. So it really sort of ran the gamut. But yeah, lots of different meanings were associated to it.
I hope you don't mind if I read an extract from your book, Concrete Concept, Brutalist Buildings Around the World.
Go for it, Henry.
That's horrible to be quoted out. So you've written the 2010s, the decade we're in, are defined by an icy cocktail of hedonism and cynicism, lives underwritten by social networking and shopping, sex and narcissism, high capitalism triumphant. Architecture today is the built environment, you've put that in quotation marks, eco-architecture, tourist architecture, money-making architecture, iconic rebrand architecture, pop-up architecture. Do you think that the changes that have taken place in society, in places where brutalism was prevalent in the 50s, 60s and 70s, have been reflected in architecture? And if so, how?
Obviously, societies change and our views change. And it's a long story, isn't it? You know, all the different things that have changed in the last 50 years. I think we live in more individualistic times, more consumerist times. And what I've tried to do with this book and with my novel, The Wall in the Head, which is also sort of exploring those ideas around, I guess, the utopias that people wanted to create in the post-war period, is just to sort of re-examine those ideas as well and see how they fit into sort of modern day. Because you have a sort of interesting timeline where you have these ideas kind of dying out, really. So, you know, the ideas of the utopias and megastructures and things, they became terribly unfashionable. You know, people are interested in them again, and I think people want to investigate those ideas. And I think the architecture stands up really well, and I think that is one of the reasons why people are interested in it. I mean, for a long time, people have decried these buildings as ugly, and I think when people say ugly, what they mean is difficult, really. So, you know, in the way that art, you know, painting can be difficult, or a novel can be difficult, or a film can be difficult, you need time to understand those things. And because these buildings, these brutalist buildings, concrete buildings, are often very abstract. You know, lots of layers, often quite hard to work out how to get into them half the time with all the walkways and ramps and things. I think it takes time to sort of understand them. And I think we're trying to understand them more these days. There's a lot of books coming out and people making documentaries and things. And I guess that's ultimately what I wanted to do, just try and sort of get under the skin of these places, but also to kind of explore how we experience them. I'm really interested in how we experience architecture. And I think it's interesting to move beyond the cliches of concrete buildings as being kind of dystopias where people just go and take crack and, you know, they sort of burnt out cars and stuff. They can be that. And I've been to a lot of places that are like that. But they're also places that can be, you know, you can feel that optimistic spirit from the 60s. And they're also places I've sort of wanted to explore ideas about how they could maybe be the backdrops to romances or comedies, sort of reinvestigating the ideas that we've kind of taken for granted and seeing how these buildings can be sort of experienced again in a different way today.
You mentioned that you can feel the optimistic spirit of the 60s when you go back to some of these buildings. Do you think...
Not all of them.
I think it's fair to say that brutalism is sexy right now. It's sexy, perhaps again, it's fair to say. But
Henry,
I think
if you want to say it's sexy, I will let you say that.
I'm going to just go out there and say it's sexy. But I wonder, is this new sexiness a reflection of enlightenment or nostalgia?
That's a really good question. Probably elements of both, I imagine. Yeah, I think we're finding new sort of levels of understanding. Yeah, we are nostalgic. And I sometimes worry if that's a bad thing. I sort of feel in my own writing that I deal with a lot of these nostalgic kind of thoughts and nostalgic ideas. But I think it's a human trait to be nostalgic. When you're sat on a train, I think your mind kind of wanders to the past, and it's just a sort of natural thing to do that. And certainly when we look at, you know, some things that are changing today, like the death of the welfare state and stuff, I think you can understand why people are kind of looking back fondly on an era when we had free healthcare and education, in Britain at least.
That was writer and architecture critic Christopher Beanland talking about his new book entitled Concrete Concept. Brutalism, that hulking brand of concrete-clad modernism, has become synonymous with a few now-lauded buildings. London's Balfron and Trellick Towers were so reviled when they were built in the late 60s and early 70s, respectively, that author Ian Fleming was driven to name one of his most famous villains after the architect, Erno Goldfinger.
Today, both buildings are listed and represent a widespread reappraisal of the material in use. But London isn't the only place that brutalism left its mark. With this in mind, I headed off to an unlikely and little-known spot elsewhere in the UK to find out more. Sheffield, England. Its internationally important role in 19th-century steel production earned it the moniker Steel City. Most of the steel's gone now, but plenty remains of a different industrial material, concrete. The jewel in Sheffield's concrete crown is Park Hill, a massive brutalist housing estate that brought continental modernism to South Yorkshire in the 1960s. I travelled to Sheffield to learn more about the block's chequered history. I began my day by visiting the vast abandoned courtyards of Park Hill with Patrick Murphy, founder and director of the annual Sheffield Design Week.
What we're looking at now is unfinished concrete, essentially. So the pillars that we're stood next to, you can see how it was made, you can see the formwork where the wooden mould was. It's actually a design that connects a series of large tower blocks, essentially. Where we're stood now is we're surrounded by concrete structure. And to think of these once empty spaces being full of families and to hear, you know, children playing, it would have been a very much different kind of atmosphere. But yeah, it is slightly surreal now. It's kind of very Soviet-esque, I guess, in terms of its size.
Park Hill was opened in 1961, emerging out of a very specific social and political context. Satwinder Samra is the director of Future Practice and a senior university teacher at the Sheffield School of Architecture.
So Sheffield, as a lot of the country, was facing acute housing shortages. And we had conditions of poverty and quite a lot of slum conditions. And so post-war, there was a sense that we needed to lead in terms of new housing provision. So Sheffield, led by the chief city architect, decided that there needed to be a number of new housing schemes built within the city, one of which would be Park Hill. There was a political will, but that was backed up by a kind of a trust and an idea that architects had a social purpose. And at the time, leading architects, the must-have job would be working in local authorities. So there was a sense that one should provide for this kind of quite difficult need. And so at the time, the architects would work on proposals. And in particular in Park Hill, what was interesting was that the existing houses had street names and there were existing communities. And within the development of the new, there was this idea that they would try and keep the communities together through the design of the new. So the site's quite complicated in terms of its slope. And the proposal that they developed was very much one of thinking about how the architecture could respond, but in particular using or being influenced by kind of modernist principles of daylight, kind of the idea that the structure might have a certain sort of rigour to it, and also the materials, which for some people can be seen to be quite aggressive, and this idea of brutal can be quite problematic. But at the time, it was very much about offering views, offering daylight. The project had quite a sophisticated waste disposal system within it, and there was proper sanitation. So if you can imagine, you're going from a kind of Sheffield terrace, which might be quite cramped, quite dark, quite gloomy, not great sanitation, to something which is quite brave, which is almost like a nostalgia for the future.
Simon Ogden is head of city regeneration at Sheffield City Council.
What was special about Park Hill was not just the architecture, but the trouble that the team took to actually maintain the social structures of the families and streets that moved into those buildings. So there was actually a sociologist on the design team for Park Hill in the 50s who went round and found out who was related to everybody else in the slums and made sure that all those family groups were linked together and that whole streets, where possible, were moved onto the new streets. And that was one of the reasons why it worked so well. The success lasted quite a long time, really. I would say probably the first 30 years of its life, it was regarded as being a good place to live and was sought after. after that time, that first generation of families started to dwindle, and the kind of the way that they used Park Hill, where, you know, you see the pictures from the 60s where mums and grandmas used to sit outside the flats on and look after the kids, and you know, people went in and out of their houses. As that generation moved on, people moved in who were a lot more private in their behaviour. I think that the maintenance of the blocks was not up to scratch, so people started to get fed up with lifts breaking down and smelling of pee and so on. I think there was also a kind of a learnt behaviour that people saw it just as being another high-rise block, and therefore assumed that the behaviour that went along with that was kind of antisocial and rather selfish. So you got people moving in there and using it just as an address to pick up benefit, or you know, you got a different attitude towards it. It wasn't a place where people were moving with their family. It was just an address.
Despite its decline, in 1998, English Heritage controversially gave Park Hill Grade 2 listed status, making it the largest listed building in Europe. In 2004, developers Urban Splash were approached by Sheffield Council to redevelop the block. Simon Green is Executive Director of Place at Sheffield City Council.
We entered into a development agreement with the developers Urban Splash a few years ago now, and they are on our behalf refurbishing the Park Hill over a period of several years. We're currently towards the end of phase one. It was set back a little because of the clear global recession in terms of property. But now phase one is coming to an end. It's been very successful. And what we're seeing are a complete rebuild and refurbishment of living units, and on the ground two floors, commercial. And the commercial space is being let to very much an artistic and creative set of industries, and has been quite a surprise, actually. Sheffield is very buoyant with regard to creative industries, but actually them relocating to that particular part of the city was a surprise, a nice surprise. It has helped the financials and the viability of the project. It has also helped let and sell the units above the commercial activity.
Human Design Studio was the first business to move into one of the renovated commercial spaces at Park Hill. Nick Bax is their creative director.
The company's been going for 7 years, and before we were based in Globeworks, which is another Grade 2 listed building on the other side of the city, and it was actually an old cutlery works. It was a nice historic place to be, and we've been there 5 years and enjoyed being there. But I'd always had my eye on Park Hill, and yeah, I think, you know, it's just such an iconic place. And again, it's got a lot of history to it. And when we had a chance to come here, we jumped at it.
Do you think Park Hill's sexy?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it is. You know, I think it's because it's quite dangerous and daring. Not as a location, but in terms of like an aesthetic.
Park Hill was born out of a post-war context that was optimistic, forward-looking, and relatively socially cohesive. The brave new world suggested by the building's brutalist aesthetic complemented this outlook, a kind of nostalgia for the future, as Setwinder put it. The effort to redevelop the building is commendable, and certainly better than leaving it redundant or demolishing it. On one of the concrete bridges connecting the two blocks, there's a well-known bit of graffiti facing out to the city that outlasted the building's original residents. It reads, "Claire Middleton, I love you, will you marry me?" The words, "I love you, will you marry me?" have been overlaid in neon by Urban Splash and are beamed out over the city at nightfall. It's a nice touch, but to me is emblematic of the reappraisal of Park Hill and other once-derided British brutalist buildings in recent years. Fueled not by a nostalgia for the future, but a plain nostalgia for what historian David Kynaston calls a better yesterday. For Monocle, in Sheffield, I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan.
And you can learn more about modernism and brutalism in Sheffield from the Modernist Guide to Sheffield. Check it out at modernistguides.com.
Still to come on the show, we wonder at the uses of concrete in product design and mull over the future of this most permanent of materials.
Despite the optimism writ large in many of the concrete structures that were erected throughout the 20th century, modern-day architects are realising the material's drawbacks are more than merely aesthetic.
As well as requiring substantial upkeep, concrete constructions are also labour-intensive and create and present a problem for those keen on recycling their materials.
We spoke to Guillaume Habert, Professor of Sustainable Construction at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, to find out if concrete has an interesting future to match its storied past.
You had this amazing material that was so cheap, easy to use, relatively fast. So, of course, then especially after the Second World War, you have all these buildings that somehow we know now that have been built. And we realized, let's say, two things. The first is that it's really easy to implement, but somehow after 20, 30, 40 years, your building starts to have cracks or to deteriorate much more, let's say, than a traditional stone building. And then you need maintenance. So you need to invest again to have a nice building, which clearly we didn't do with all the massive mass housing that we did in Europe, especially after the Second World War. So you had the first, let's say, the bad impression about the concrete is that the structure, if you don't maintain them, they start to deteriorate. And so you have a, let's say, not so nice impression about the building. So that was, I think, the first drawback of the concrete is that it looks marvelous, but at the end you need still a little bit of maintenance. And the second aspect is clearly that comes so late and clearly now is the 21st century, is that with concrete you have a lot of CO2 emissions that are associated because it's a relatively energy-intensive material to produce. So the cement, to produce the cement, you need a lot of energy, and so you're releasing CO2. Which has influence on the climate change. And we estimate that the concrete industry is responsible of something like, let's say, 10% of the CO2 that are released by the human activity. So it has an impact on the planet, and it has an impact also aesthetically with the deterioration of the structure.
I wonder if you could point us to a brighter rather than a greyer future and tell us, you know, perhaps which buildings are using concrete today in a useful or sustainable way. Some of the examples of the work which is taking on board your research, but actually, you know, maintains part of, you know, it's still important in the process of making these buildings.
The problem we have with the concrete is that it has a bad, or let's say it is loved by some architects. It has a bad perception in the society because it's grey, because of all also the probably the mistake that have been done in the early 70s or 60s, and so now when we try to implement a new good way to implement probably in the right way the concrete, you can always have this kind of misconception or let's say difficulty to show that it has effectively a potential. The great potential with the concrete is when you use it to for the structure of the buildings. So because it has a high strength, you can use really small amount of material to provide great arches or structure. And what we are trying to push forward now is to say concrete is not necessarily bad. It has just to be used at the right place, at the right amount. And that maybe you have other places in the buildings where maybe you don't need concrete. So where you can fill with wood, with brick, with earth, or with plenty of other things that require less energy, and that you keep the concrete for the places where you really need to have a hard structure that can sustain earthquake, for instance. The nice building that has been built recently in Switzerland is the combination of wood and concrete, where you use a little bit of the concrete just to get the strength, and the most of the building is at the end is filled by or is made by wood element, and so you have really reduced a lot the place where you really use the concrete. That's probably one, I think, interesting possibility.
That was Guillaume Habert, Professor of Sustainable Construction at the Department of Civil, Environmental and Geomatic Engineering at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology.
And I'm joined now in studio by Monocle's Chiara Ramella, who's in an item which we've refrained from calling Chiara's Drawers. Chosen three items made out of concrete in which the industrial design of the product is integral to the finished article. And one thing I can see in front of me is a rather beautiful concrete egg cup by a company, I believe, called Menschmade. Can you tell me more about it, Chiara?
Indeed. So the company is based in the Netherlands, in Eindhoven, but the founder, Doreen Westphal, was born in East Germany, where I expect she probably saw quite a lot of concrete in her time. These objects are egg cups, shaped, in fact, like half of a boiled egg, where the egg is positioned where the yolk would normally be. And they also come with a magnet at the very top of the point of the egg so that you can sort of hover your spoon attached to this comely design.
Yeah, I really love the design. I think I saw these for the first time at Maison et Objet, the trade show in Paris, and they really caught my eye because it's not something you'd expect to be made out of concrete. I didn't realise that there was this conscious or unconscious referencing of the kind of the built environment where she grew up, but that's a lovely detail that goes with a very nice item. What else have you got for me, Chiara?
So I'd like to cross over to Buenos Aires and Chicago. This wine holder, wine chiller that I've got for you was designed by Francisco Corvi, who's a Buenos Aires-based designer, but is made in Chicago and is retailed by Interconcrete, which is a company, it's a Chicago-based company, as you can imagine by their name, quite into concrete.
Yeah, I can imagine they make a lot of hay out of that. So, what's the purpose? I'm thinking to myself, if I take that bottle of wine out of this sort of like a holder that comes up to the neck of the bottle, am I going to chip the bottom of it? Is this a useful design or is this concrete for concrete's sake?
You could be tempted to think that in the vein of the industrial warehouse-like fashion into going a bit brutalist, this could be just an aesthetic stance, aesthetic position. But actually, the reason why the designers use concrete is because concrete is a very useful material when it comes to insulation. It has very good properties in that sense. And if you pop this kind of faceted design into the freezer for a fair few hours before you need to put your bottle inside it, it will keep your bottle chilled for hours and hours and hours on end. So there's a point, indeed.
No, I like it. I like it. And it's actually got something of a kind of like a brutalist shape to it, as you mentioned. It looks like some sort of off-the-wall Polish church or something. It's just lucky that I have some sense of scale and I can see a wine bottle poking out of the top of it, where the cross should be. On to our final item. What have I got here? Is this something I can hold in my hand, perhaps?
Indeed. So talk about weighty pens. This is a concrete pen made by 22 Design Studio. They are based in Taipei, Taiwan, and all of what they do is made from concrete and steel, inspired again by the kind of urban fabric they live in and a will to reimagine and reinterpret what they're surrounded by. I thought it was just quite interesting because you do want to have something that feels weighty in your hand, but there's that, and then there's having a concrete pen. Although, again, this isn't just an aesthetic choice. Concrete was used in this case because, despite being very strong, it is a material that kind of chips away a little at the edges. And by using this pen, the material itself will mould after use and it will adapt to the hold and shape of your hands. So it will create a properly kind of bespoke pen.
It's very useful. Yeah, I like it. It's really nice. I suppose there's also some tactile aspect to all of these items whereby, you know, concrete is used for its strength. You know, perhaps it's not always the most sustainable thing to use, but there is something quite nice about holding something hefty. And if you are paying for a designer, if you're paying for a product that someone has taken a lot of thought over, it is quite nice, isn't it, that there's this element of heaviness and of permanence to it. But as someone that helps look after the product design pages, Chiara, do you like these concrete objects? Are they referencing an architectural style of bygone days, or is there any future to it?
I like the brutalist revival. I really do. Although I think it's been pushed a bit too far by people who are kind of jumping onto it and then making concrete everything. So I think let's stick to things that actually benefit from being made out of concrete. And I think architecture is top of the list. And then product design, whenever it actually has a point.
I like it, I like it. And what have we learned here? Don't lend anyone your pen. They'll ruin it. That was Monocles at Chiara Romella. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And sadly, that's all for this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, and the show's producer, right opposite me, the lovely Henry Rhys Sheridan. And a special thanks this week to Charlie Young for his help.
If you have any comments or queries, then feel free to drop me a line. I'm at hrs@monocle.com. We're back next week at the same time, and you can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes.
Or better yet, let us know what you think with a review on any of the above or a comment to tell us how we're doing. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett.
And I'm Henry Sheridan. Until next time, goodbye.